Shimmering fire protruded from the bookshelf, the books, the walls, and the thick folds of Brianna's skirts. One had whizzed past Roger's head, barely nicking his ear. A thin trickle of blood was running down his neck, though he didn't seem to have noticed yet. A stipple of brilliant pinpoints glinted on the table. A shower of the sharp needles had been thrust upward through the inch-thick wood. I heard Ian exclaim sharply, and Ben to pull a tiny shaft from the flesh of his calf. Jemmy began to cry. Outside, Rollo the dog was barking furiously. The opal had exploded. It was still broad daylight. The candle flame was nearly invisible, no more than a waver of heat in the late afternoon light from the window. Jamie blew out the taper he had used to light it and sat down behind his desk.
"You didn't sense anything odd about yon stone when you gave it to the lad, Sassenach?"
"No." I still felt shaken by the explosion, the echoes of that eerie noise still chiming in my inner ear. It felt warm, but everything in the room is warm. And it certainly wasn't making that noise.
Noise?
He looked at me queerly.
When it went bang, do you mean?
Now it was my turn to look askance. No, before that. Didn't you hear it? He shook his head, a small frown between his brows, and I glanced round at the others. Bree and Roger nodded. Both of them looked pale and ill. But Ian shook his head, looking interested but puzzled.
"I didn't hear a thing," he said. "What did it sound like?"
Brianna opened her mouth to answer, but Jamie raised a hand to stop her.
"A moment, Ian. Jem, Arue, did you hear a noise before the bang?"
Jemmy had settled down from his fright, but was still crouching in his mother's lap, thumb in his mouth. He looked at his grandfather out of wide blue eyes that had already begun to show a definite slant, and slowly nodded, not removing the thumb.
"And the stone Granny gave you, it was hot."
Jemmy cast a glare of intense accusation in my direction and nodded again. I felt a small surge of guilt, followed by a much larger one, when I thought of what might have happened had Bree not snatched him up at once. We had picked most of the splinters out of the woodwork. They lay on the desk in a small heap of brittle fire. One had sliced a tiny flap of skin from my knuckle. I put it in my mouth, tasting silver blood. My God! Those things are as sharp as broken glass. They are broken glass. Brianna clutched Jem a little closer.
Glass? You mean it wasn't a real opal?
Roger raised his brows, leaning forward to pick up one of the needle-like shards. Sure it is, but opals are glass. Really hard volcanic glass. Gemstones are gemstones because they have a crystalline structure that makes them pretty. Opals just have a really brittle structure compared to most. The colour was beginning to come back into Brianna's face, though she kept her arms wrapped tightly round her son. "I knew you could break one if you hit with a hammer or something, but I never heard of one doing that." She nodded at the pile of glimmering fragments. Jamie picked a large shard out of the pile with finger and thumb and held it out to me.
"Put it in your hand, Sassenach. Does it feel warm to you?"
I accepted the jagged piece of stone gingerly. It was thin, nearly weightless, and translucent, sparkling with vivid blues and oranges. "Yes," I said, tilting my palm cautiously to and fro. "Not remarkably hot, just about skin temperature."
"It felt cool to me," Jamie said. "Give it to Ian."
I transferred the bit of opal to Ian, who put it in the palm of his hand and stroked it cautiously with a fingertip, as though it were some small animal that might bite him if annoyed.
"It feels cool," he reported, "like a bit of glass, like Cousin Brianna says."
A bit more experimentation established that the stone felt warm, though not strikingly so, to Brianna, Roger and me, but not to Jamie or Ian. By this time the wax had melted in the top of the big clock candle, allowing Jamie to extract the gemstones hidden there. He fished them out, rubbed the last of the hot wax off on his handkerchief, and lay them out in a row along the edge of the desk to cool. Jemmy watched this with great interest, his misadventure apparently forgotten.
"Do you like these, Angela Roy?"
Jamie asked him, and he nodded eagerly, leaning out of his mother's lap, reaching toward the stones.
"Hot," he said.
Then, remembering, shrank back a little, a look of doubt crossing his small, blunt features.
"Hot?"
"Well, I do hope not," his grandfather said.
He took a deep breath, picked up the emerald, a crudely faceted stone the size of his thumbnail.
"Put out your hand, Avalach."
Brianna looked as though she wanted to protest, but bit her lower lip and encouraged Jemmy to do as his grandfather asked. He took the stone, looking suspicious, but then the look of wariness faded into a smile as he looked down at the stone.
"Pretty rock."
"Is it hot?" Brianna asked, poised to snatch it out of his hand.
"Yes, hot,"
he said with satisfaction, holding it against his stomach. "Let Mama see." With a little difficulty, Brianna succeeded in getting her fingers onto the rock, though Jemmy wouldn't surrender it.
"It's warm," she said, looking up. "Like the piece of opal, but not way hot." "If it gets way hot, you drop it fast, okay?" she said to Jemmy.
Roger had been watching this with fascination.
"He's got it, hasn't he?" he said softly. 50-50, you said. Or 3 chances in 4, depending. But he's got it, doesn't he?"
"What?"
Jamie glanced at Roger, then at me, one red brow raised in question.
"I think he can travel," I said, feeling a tightening of my chest at the thought.
"You know what Ottertooth said?" I nodded at the journal, which lay discarded on the desk. "He said they had to take a test to see if they could hear the voice of time. We know that not everyone can do this." I felt unaccountably shy talking of it before Ian. "But some can. From what Ottertooth said, there was a way of finding out who could and couldn't ahead of time without having actually to try." Jamie was paying no attention to the grown-up conversation, instead rocking back and forth, humming to the stone clutched in his pudgy hand.
"Do you suppose the voice of time is...
Jem, can you hear the rock?"
Roger leaned forward, taking hold of Jemmy's arm to compel his attention away from the emerald.
"Jem, is the rock singing to you?"
Jemmy looked up, surprised.
"No,"
he said uncertainly. Then,
"yes."
He held the rock up to his ear, frowning, then thrust it at Roger.
"You sing, Daddy."
Roger accepted the emerald gingerly, smiling at Jemmy.
"I don't know any rock songs,"
he said in his husky rasp of a voice,
"unless you count the Beatles."
He lifted the rock to his own ear, looking self-conscious. He listened intently, frowning, then lowered his hand, shaking his head.
"It's not... I can't. I couldn't really say I hear anything. And yet... Here, you try."
He passed the stone to Brianna, and she in turn to me. Neither of us heard anything in particular, and yet I thought I could perceive something if I listened very hard. Not exactly a sound, more a sense of very, very faint vibration.
"What is it?" Ian asked.
He'd been following the proceedings with rapt interest.
"You're no Shehanach, the three of you. But why is it you can do what you do and Uncle Jamie and I canna?" "You can't, can you, Uncle Jamie?" he asked dubiously.
"No, thank God,"
his uncle replied.
"It's genetic, isn't it?"
Brianna asked, looking up.
"It has to be."
Jamie and Ian looked wary at the unfamiliar term.
"Genetic?"
Ian asked. His feathery brows drew together in puzzlement. "Why shouldn't it be?" I said. "Everything else is. Blood type, eye colour."
"But everyone has eyes and blood, Sassenach,"
Jamie objected.
Whatever colour his eyes may be, everyone can see. This.
He waved at the small collection of stones. I sighed with impatience.
Yes, but there are other things that are genetic. Everything, if you come right down to it. Look.
I turned to him and stuck out my tongue. Jamie blinked, and Brianna giggled at his expression.
Disregarding this, I pulled in my tongue and put it out again, this time with the edges rolled up into a cylinder.
What about that? I asked, popping it back in.
Can you do that?
Jamie looked amused.
Of course I can.
He stuck out a rolled tongue and wiggled it, demonstrating, then pulled it back.
Everyone can do that, surely. Ian?
Oh, aye, of course,
Ian obligingly demonstrated. Anyone can.
I can't, said Brianna. Jamie stared at her, taken aback.
What do you mean you can't?
Bleh!
She stuck out a flat tongue and waggled it from side to side. I can't.
Of course you can, Jamie frowned. Here it's simple, lass. Anyone can do it.
He stuck out his own tongue again, rolling and unrolling it like a paternal anteater, anxiously encouraging its offspring toward an appetizing mass of insects. He glanced at Roger, brows lifted.
You'd think so, wouldn't you?
Roger said ruefully. He stuck out his own tongue. Flat.
Bleh.
See? I said triumphantly. Some people can roll their tongues and some simply can't. It can't be learned. You're born with it or you're not. Jamie looked from Bree to Roger and back, frowning, then turned to me.
Allowing for the moment that you may be right, why can the lass not do it if you and I both can? You did assure me she's my daughter, aye?
She is most assuredly your daughter, I said, as anyone with eyes in their head could tell you.
He glanced at Brianna, taking in her lean height and mass of ruddy hair. She smiled at him, blue eyes creasing into triangles. He smiled back and turned to me, shrugging in good-natured capitulation.
Well, I shall take your word for it, Sassenach, as an honourable woman. But the tongue, then?
He rolled his own again, in doubtful fashion, still not quite believing that anyone couldn't do it if they put their mind to it.
Well, you do know where babies come from, I began. The egg and the...
I do,
he said, with a noticeable edge to his voice. The tips of his ears turned slightly pink.
I mean, it takes something from the mother and something from the father.
I could feel my own cheeks pinken slightly, but carried on gamely. Sometimes the father's influence is more visible than the mother's, sometimes the other way round. But both, influences are still there. We call them genes, the things babies get from their two parents that affect the child's appearance and abilities. Jamie glanced at Jemmy, who was humming again, engaged in trying to balance one gemstone on top of another, the sunlight glinting off his coppery hair. Looking back, he caught Roger's eye and quickly turned his attention to me.
Aye, so?
Well, genes affect more than simply hair or eye colour. Now, I warmed to my lecture, each person has two genes for every trait, one from the father and one from the mother. And when the, gametes are formed in the ovaries and testes...
Perhaps you should tell me all about it later, Sassenach,
Jamie interrupted with a sidelong glance at Brianna. Evidently, he didn't think the word testes suitable for his daughter's ears. His own were blazing.
It's all right, Da. I know where babies come from,
Bree assured him, grinning. Well then, I said, taking back command of the conversation. You have a pair of genes for each trait, one gene from your mother and one gene from your father. But when the time comes to pass these on to your own offspring, you can only pass one of the pair, because the child will get another gene from his other parent. You see? I raised an eyebrow at Jamie and Roger, who nodded in unison as though hypnotized.
Right. Well then, some genes are said to be dominant and others recessive. If a person has a dominant gene, then that's the one that will be expressed, will be visible. They may have another gene that's recessive, and so you don't see it, but it can still be passed to the offspring.
My collective audience looked wary.
"Surely you learned this in school, Roger?" Bree asked, amused.
"Well, I did," he muttered. "But I think perhaps I wasn't paying proper attention at the time. After all, I wasn't expecting it actually to matter."
"Right," I said dryly. "Well then, you and I, Jamie, evidently each have one of the dominant genes that allows us to roll our tongues. But," I continued, raising a finger, "we must also each have a recessive gene that doesn't allow tongue rolling. And evidently, each of us gave the recessive gene to Bree. Therefore, she can't roll her tongue. Likewise, Roger must have two copies of the non-rolling recessive gene, since if he had even one of the dominant genes, he could do it. And he can't. QED. I bowed.
"What's testes?"
inquired a small voice. Roger had abandoned his rocks and was looking up at me in profound interest. I said. I glanced round the room in search of aid.
"That's Latin for your balls, lad," Roger said gravely, suppressing a grin.
Jemmy looked quite interested at that.
"I got balls? Where I got balls?"
Said Roger, and glanced at Jamie.
"Mm-hmm,"
said Jamie, and looked at the ceiling.
"Well, you do have a kilt on, Uncle Jamie," Ian said, grinning.
Jamie gave his nephew a look of gross betrayal, but before he could move, Roger had leaned forward and cupped Jamie gently between the legs.
"Just there, the Valach," he said.
Jamie kneaded his crotch briefly, then looked at Roger, small strawberry brows knitted into a puzzled frown.
"Not so ball, so willy."
Jamie sighed deeply and got up. He jerked his head at Roger, then reached down and took Jemmy's hand.
"Aye, all right. Come outside with me and your da. We'll show you."
Bree's face was the exact shade of her hair, and her shoulders shook briefly. Roger, also suspiciously pink about the cheeks, had opened the door and stood aside for Jamie and Jem to go through. I didn't think Jamie paused to think about it. Seized by impulse, he turned to Jemmy, rolling up his tongue into a cylinder and sticking it out.
"Can you do that, Arui?"
he asked, pulling it back in again. Brianna drew in her breath with a sound like a startled duck and froze. Roger froze too, his eyes resting on Jemmy as though the little boy were an explosive device, primed to go off like the opal. A second too late, Jamie realized, and his cheeks went pale.
"Damn,"
he said, very quietly under his breath. Jemmy's eyes grew round with reproach.
"Bad, Granda. That's a bad word. Mama?"
"Yes," Brianna said, narrowed eyes on Jamie. "We'll have to wash Granda's mouth out with soap, won't we?"
He looked very much as though he'd already swallowed a good mouthful of soap, and lye soap at that.
"Aye,"
he said, and cleared his throat. The flush had faded entirely from his face.
"Aye, that was very wicked of me, Jeremiah. I must beg pardon of the ladies."
He bowed very formally to me and Brianna.
"Je suis navré, mesdames et monsieur," he added softly to Roger.
Roger nodded very slightly. His eyes were still on Jemmy, but his lids were lowered and his face carefully blank. Jamie's own round face assumed the expression of beatific delight that he wore whenever French was spoken near him, and, as Jamie had clearly intended, broke immediately into his own pet contribution to that language of art and chivalry.
"Frère Jacques, Frère Jacques."
Roger looked up at Bree, and something seemed to pass through the air between them. He reached down and took hold of Jem's other hand, momentarily interrupting his song.
"So, Avalach, can you do it then?"
"Frère, do what?"
"Look at Granda."
Roger nodded at Jamie, who took a deep breath and quickly put out his tongue, rolled into a cylinder.
"Can you do that?" Roger asked.
"Sure,"
Jemmy beamed, and put out his tongue. Flat.
Bleh.
A collective sigh gusted through the room. Jemmy, oblivious, swung his legs up, his weight suspended momentarily from Roger's and Jamie's hands, then stomped his feet down on the floor again, recalling his original question.
"Can Dar got's balls?"
he asked, pulling on the men's hands and tilting his head far back to look up at Jamie.
"Aye, lad, I have," Jamie said dryly. "But your Dar's are bigger. Come on, then."
And to the sound of Jemmy's tuneless chanting, the men trundled him outside, hanging like a gibbon between them, his knees drawn up to his chin. Chapter 110. Man of Blood. I crumbled dry sage leaves in my hands, letting the grey-green flakes fall into the burning coals. The sun hung low in the sky above the chestnut trees, but the small burying ground lay already in shadow, and the fire was bright. The five of us stood in a circle around the chunk of granite with which Jamie had marked the stranger's grave.
There were five of us, and so we laid the circle with five points.
By common consent, this was not only for the man with the silver fillings, but for his four unknown companions, and for Daniel Rawlings, whose fresh and final grave lay under a mountain ash nearby. The smoke rose up from the small iron firepot, pale and fragrant. I had brought other herbs as well, but I knew that for the Tuscarora, for the Cherokee, and for the Mohawk, sage was holy, the smoke of it cleansing. I rubbed juniper needles between my hands into the fire, and followed them with rue, called Herb of Grace, and rosemary. That's for remembrance, after all. The leaves of the trees nearby rustled gently in the evening breeze, and the twilight lit the drifting smoke, turning it from grey to gold as it rose up and up into heaven's vault, where the faint stars waited. Jamie lifted his head, touched with fire as bright as the blaze by his feet, and looked toward the west where the souls of the dead fly away. He spoke softly, in Gaelic, but all of us knew enough by now to follow.
"Thou goest home this night, to thy home of winter, to thy home of autumn, of spring, and of summer. Thou goest home this night to thy perpetual home, to thine eternal bed, to thine eternal slumber. The sleep of the seven lights be thine, O brother. The sleep of the seven joys be thine, O brother. The sleep of the seven slumbers be thine, O brother. On the arm of the Jesus of blessing, the Christ of grace. The shade of death lies upon thy face, beloved, but the Jesus of grace has his hand round about thee. In nearness to the Trinity, farewell to thy pains. Christ stands before thee, and peace is in his mind."
Ian stood by him, close but not touching. The fading light touched his face, fierce upon his scars. He said it first in the Mohawk tongue, but then in English for the rest of us.
"Be the hunt successful. Be your enemies destroyed before your eyes. Be your heart ever joyful in the lodge of your brothers." "He had meant to say it over and over again a good many times," he added, ducking his head apologetically. "We the drums, aye. But I thought once would do, for now." "That will do fine, Ian," Jamie assured him,
and then looked toward Roger. Roger coughed and cleared his throat, then spoke, the husk of his voice as transparent and as penetrating as the smoke.
"Lord, make me to know mine end, and the measure of my days what it is, that I may know how frail I am. Behold, thou hast made my days as an handbreadth, and mine age is as nothing before thee. Hear my prayer, O Lord, and give ear unto my cry. Hold not thy peace at my tears, for I am a stranger with thee, and a sojourner, as all my fathers were."
We stood in silence then, as the darkness came quietly around us. As the last of the light faded, and the leaves overhead lost their brilliance, Brianna picked up the pitcher of water and poured it over the pot of coals. Smoke and steam rose up in a ghostly cloud, and the scent of remembrance drifted through the trees. It was nearly dark as we came down the narrow trail back to the house. I could see Brianna in front of me, though, leading the way. The men were a little behind us. The fireflies were out in great profusion, drifting through the trees and lighting the grass near my feet. One of the little bugs lighted briefly in Brianna's hair and clung there for a moment, blinking. A wood at twilight holds a deep hush that bids the heart be still. The foot stepped lightly on the earth.
"Have you thought, then, Nacleavan?"
Jamie said behind me. His voice was low, the tone of it friendly enough, but the formal address made it clear that the question was seriously meant.
"Of what?"
Roger's voice was calm, hushed from the service, the rasp of it barely audible.
"Of what ye shall do, you and your family. Now that ye ken both that the wee lad can travel, and what it might mean if you stay."
What it might mean to them all. I drew breath uneasily. War, battle, uncertainty, save for the certainty of danger. The danger of illness or accident for Brianna and Jem. The danger of death in the toils of childbirth, if she was again with child. And for Roger? Danger both of body and soul. His head had healed, but I saw the stillness at the back of his eyes when he thought of Randall Lillywhite.
"Oh, aye,"
Roger said, softly, invisible behind me.
"I have thought, and I'm still thinking. Maha Kaylee."
I smiled a little to hear him call Jamie father-in-law, but the tone of his voice was altogether serious.
"Shall I tell you what I think, and you will tell me?" "Aye, do that. There is time still for thinking. I've been thinking lately of Herman Husband, the Quaker."
Jamie sounded surprised. Husband had left the colony with his family after the Battle of Alamance. I thought I heard that they had gone to Maryland.
"Aye, him. What do you think might have happened had he not been a Quaker? Had he gone ahead and led the Regulators to their war?"
Jamie grunted slightly, thinking.
"I dinna ken," he said, though he sounded interested. "You mean they might have succeeded with a proper leader?" "Aye. Or maybe not. They'd no weapons after all. But they would have done better than they did. And if so..."
We had come within sight of the house now. Light was glowing in the back windows as the hearth fire was stoked up for the evening, the candles lit for supper.
"What's going to happen here, I am thinking, had the regulation been properly led? Perhaps it would have started here and then, not 3 years from now in Massachusetts." "Aye, and if so, what then?"
Roger gave a brief snort, the verbal equivalent of a shrug.
"Who knows? I know what's going on in England now. They're not ready. They've no notion of what they're risking here. If war were to break out suddenly with little warning, if it had broken out at Alamance, it might spread quickly. It might be over before the English had a clue what was happening. It might have saved years of warfare, thousands of lives."
"Or not,"
Jamie said dryly, and Roger laughed.
"Or not," he agreed. "But the point there is this. I think there are times for men of peace, and a time for men of blood as well."
Brianna had reached the house, but turned and waited for the rest of us. She had been listening to the conversation too. Roger stopped beside her, looking up. Bright sparks flew from the chimney in a firework shower, lighting his face by their glow.
"You called me,"
he said at last, still looking up into the blazing dark.
"At the gathering, at the fire."
Jamie said quietly,
"Aye, I did. Stand by my side, Roger the Singer, son of Jeremiah."
Roger said,
"Stand by my side, son of my house. Did you mean that? You know that I did. Then, I mean it too.
He reached out and rested his hand on Jamie's shoulder, and I saw the knuckles whiten as he squeezed.
I will stand by you. We will stay.
Beside me, Brianna let out the breath she had been holding, in a sigh like the twilight wind. Chapter 111.
And yet, go out to meet it. The big clock candle had burned down a little, but there were still a good many of the black rings that marked the hours. Jamie dropped the stones back into the pool of melted wax around the flame. 1, 2, 3. And blew it out. The fourth stone, the big topaz, was ensconced in a small wooden box which I'd sewn up in oiled cloth. It was bound for Edinburgh, consigned to Mrs. Bugg's cousin's husband, who, with his banking connections, would manage the sale of the stone and, with the deduction of a suitable commission for his help, would see the funds transmitted to Ned Gowan. The accompanying letter, lying sealed in the box with the stone, charged Ned to determine whether one Lyra Mackenzie was living with a man in a state tantamount to marriage, and, if so, further charged him to declare the contract between one Lyra Mackenzie and one James Fraser to be fulfilled, whereupon the funds from the sale of the stone were to be placed on deposit in a bank to be used for the dowry of one Joan Mackenzie Fraser, daughter of the aforesaid Lyra, when she should marry. "You're sure you don't want to ask Ned particularly to tell you who the man is?" I asked. He shook his head firmly.
"If he chooses to tell me, that's fine. And if he doesn't, that's fine as well."
He looked up at me with a faint wry look. Unsatisfied curiosity was to be his penance, evidently. Down the hall I could hear Brianna simultaneously talking to Mrs. Bugg and admonishing Jemmy, then Roger's voice interrupting, and Jemmy's excited squeal as Roger swept him up into the air.
"Do you think Roger chose well?" I asked quietly.
I was very glad of Roger's decision, and knew that Jamie was as well. But in spite of the peculiar perspective that Brianna, Roger and I had on coming events, I knew that Jamie had far better an idea of what was truly coming. And if the stone passage had its dangers, so did war. He paused, thinking, then leaned past me, reaching for a small volume at the end of the bookcase. It was bound cheaply in cloth and much used, an edition of Thucydides he had acquired in the wildly optimistic hope that Germaine and Jemmy might eventually learn sufficient Greek to read it. He opened the book gently to keep the pages from falling out. Greek lettering looked to me like the conniptions of an ink-soaked worm, but he found the bit he was looking for with no difficulty.
"The bravest are surely those who have the clearest vision of what is before them, glory and danger alike, and yet, notwithstanding, go out to meet it."
The words were before him, and yet I thought he wasn't reading them from the paper, but from the pages of his memory, from the open book of his heart.
The door slammed, and I heard Roger shouting outside now, cracked voice raised in warning, calling out to Jemmy, and then his laugh, deep and half-choked as Bree said something to him, a lighter sound too far away to hear in words. Then they moved away, and there was silence, save for the sough of the wind in the trees.
"The bravest are those who have the clearest vision." "Well, you'd know about that, wouldn't you?" I said softly.
I laid a hand on his shoulder, just where it joined his neck. I traced the powerful cords of his neck with my thumb, looking at the worm writhings on the page.
He would, and so would I, for the vision he had was the one I had shown him.
He kept hold of the book, but tilted his head to one side, so that his cheek brushed my hand, and the thickness of his hair touched my wrist, soft and warm.
"Ah, no," he said, "not me. It's only brave if there's a choice about it, eh?"
I laughed, sniffed, and wiped the wrist of my free hand across my eyes.
"And you think you haven't a choice?"
He paused for a moment, then shut the book, though he continued to hold it in his hands.
No, he said at last, with a queer tone in his voice. Not now.
He turned in his chair, looking through the window. Nothing was visible but the big red spruce at the side of the clearing, and the deep shade of the oak grove behind it, tangled with the brambles of wild blackberry escaped from the yard. The blackened spot where the fiery cross had stood was overgrown now, covered with thick wild barley. The air moved, and I realized that it wasn't silent after all. The sounds of the mountain were all around us, birds calling, water rushing in the distance. And there were voices, too, speaking in the murmured traffic of daily rounds. A word by the pigpen, a call from the privy. And under and over everything, the sound of children, faint shrieks and giggles borne on the restless air.
I suppose you're right, I said, after a moment.
He was. There was no choice about it now, and the knowledge gave me a sort of peace. What was coming would come. We would meet it as best we might, and hope to survive. That was all. If we didn't, perhaps they would. I gathered the tail of his hair in my hand and twined my fingers through it, holding tight like an anchor's rope. What about the other choices, though? I asked him, looking out with him over the empty dooryard and into the shades of the forest beyond. All the ones you made that brought you here. Those were real, and bloody well brave, if you ask me. Beneath the tip of my index finger, I could feel the hair-thin line of his ancient scar buried deep beneath the ruddy waves. He leaned back against the pull of my hand and swiveled round to look up at me, so my hand now cupped the bone of his jaw.
"Oh, well," he said, smiling slightly.
His hand touched mine and drew my fingers into his.
"You'd know about that now, wouldn't you, Sassenach?"
I sat down beside him, close, my hand on his leg, and his hand on mine. We sat thus for a bit, side by side, watching the rain clouds roll in over the river like a threat of distant war. And I thought, that whether it was choice or no choice, it might be that it came to the same thing in the end. Jamie's hand still lay on mine. It tightened a little, and I glanced at him, but his eyes were still fixed somewhere past the dooryard, past the mountains and the distant clouds. His grip tightened further, and I felt the edges of my ring press into my flesh.
"When the day shall come that we do part," he said softly,
and turned to look at me.
"If my last words are not, 'I love you,' you'll ken it was because I didna have time."
The End. You've been listening to The Fiery Cross by Diana Gabaldon, narrated by Davina Porter. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books is pleased to offer the other titles in the Outlander series, all narrated by Davina Porter. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalogue, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another Recorded Book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the toll-free number found on the back of the book. You can order by phone with any major credit card, or by writing to us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalogue, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.